Time for Thinking Real Estate with the Schletke family. Good morning.
Good morning. Hey,
good morning. How are you this morning?
Doing good.
Hey, good.
What's happening?
Well, it's a beautiful day in paradise.
No, that it is.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. It was good to play golf on Saturday again at Lakeland Hills. I don't know when they're going to open. There's nobody out there.
Well, listen to the radio, strange. For God's sake.
What's that? Oh, so did it say when is it opening?
Today.
The 29th. Somebody had said that. You know, they're wonderful. The owners of that, and I don't know their names, but they're wonderful people, Greg, because they leave the flags in. They leave in the fall. They leave the flags in so that if there's not snow on the ground and you can, you know, the weather's semi-decent, you can play. We've probably played, you know, I walk and carry my bag, and I usually just do 9 holes, maybe a couple extra. But I've probably played 12 times already, or a few more than that this season. So I give high praise to the owners at Lakeland Hills. Do you know their names?
You know I do.
Who are they?
Rich and Kenny Krosick.
Spell the last name?
K-A-R-E-S-E-K. Krosick.
Yep. Yeah, okay. All right, anyway, I play all the time with a buddy of mine by the name of Pete Brown, sometimes a scratch golfer by the name of Chris Rowley. Matter of fact, Chris was out there on Saturday with me when I played in the afternoon. And, yeah, we all really very much appreciate it. Anyway, enough of that. Laura, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have a question. So I had a client who's buying a property, and the seller only wants to transfer the property via a quitclaim deed. And I said, well, you don't want a quitclaim deed. You want a warranty deed, unless it's a relative or, you know, you're going from one entity to the next. So give me your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I get this. You got to understand that I do predominantly commercial deals. And in commercial deals, we don't use a quitclaim deed. We don't use a warranty deed. What we use is a covenant deed, which is a limited warranty deed. It's halfway between a quitclaim deed and a warranty deed. But if I am a purchaser of a residence and the seller only wants to give a quitclaim deed, I want to know why. There's something that just doesn't smell right, or the attorney for the seller is just giving the seller advice because they're not familiar with residential transactions. But the overwhelming custom and practice is for a warranty deed to be given in a residential deal. And some people say, well, it doesn't matter. All I care about is a quitclaim deed because I'm getting title insurance. Well, unfortunately, if you look at the exceptions, that both the standard exceptions and the pre-printed exceptions that are set forth in the title commitment, there are certain risks that are not covered that would be covered by a warranty deed. So if I'm representing a purchaser, I'm going to put in that agreement that we're going to get a warranty deed. And if the seller's saying he's only going to give a quitclaim deed, I want to know what's going on. Why is the seller willing to give only quitclaim deed?
Yeah, and this is vacant land, so I don't know. Same thing, but not quite as intelligently as you said it. So.
Yeah, does the seller have an attorney?
I don't know. I'm dealing with a buyer on this one, and I'm just starting to deal with it.
Is there a purchase agreement in which the seller has said, I'm only giving a quitclaim deed? Where is it coming from that the seller is saying that?
It's just a verbal from the seller to the buyer.
Okay.
I have not talked to, I've only talked to the buyer. We haven't put anything in writing yet. So we're just starting, but that conversation was that the seller only wanted to give a quitclaim deed. Now, how far back does a warranty go to? Doesn't it just go to the period of time Does it tell me the history of a warranty deed? Does it go back to when the seller got ownership of the property, or does it go prior to that?
Goes back all the way back. It's a warranty deed. It's a general warranty deed that warrants against any defect in title. No, it's not limited to the owner's or the seller's ownership. That's a limited warranty deed. Limited warranty deed that we use in a commercial deal says that the seller is warranting that the seller did not do anything to adversely affect the title. That's a limited warranty deed, also known as a covenant deed. That's not a general warranty deed. General warranty deed says I'm warranting title irrespective of whether the defect happened while I owned it or the defect existed prior to my acquiring title.
Got it.
Yeah.
And what recourse do I have if I'm the buyer and there ends up being a default in the title? Is that when the title insurance kicks in, or do I have some recourse as a result of the warranty deed?
There are additional risks. If it's not covered by the title policy, it is possible that it would be covered under the warranty deed. In other words, the warranty deed does, as I mentioned at the outset, include warranties as to additional items that are not covered by the title policy. In most circumstances, the defect is going to be covered by the title policy.
Okay.
I will say that, you know, a compromise may be on the deal you're talking about. Is this the deal you asked me about the other day in which there is no realtor for the seller?
Could be. I don't know.
Remember?
That was a different deal.
Yeah. A compromise is a covenant deed, and if the purchaser is really anxious to get this property, you can negotiate it from to the middle ground, which is a covenant or a limited warranty deed. But you got to check with the title company too, because the title company may be unwilling to insure title if the seller does not give a warranty deed. So check with the title insurance company, verify that in fact it will issue its full policy even though a limited warranty deed or a quitclaim deed is being issued.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay.
All right, then let's talk about earnest money deposit.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that would be a good subject. Where do you want to start with this?
What's the purpose of an earnest money deposit?
Well, a lot of people think that without an earnest money deposit, an agreement to sell property is unenforceable. But that's absolutely false. They think that the consideration for the purchase is the earnest money deposit. It's not. Earnest money, the consideration for the purchase is the agreement on the part of the seller to sell and the agreement on the part of the purchaser to purchase. You do not need an earnest money deposit in order to have a fully binding purchase agreement. I've gotten this question numerous times over the years, both in classes that I've taught and seminars that I've taught, and from parties to a deal. You know, sometimes they've been putting in a dollar earnest money deposit just so they think they have a binding deal. They got a binding deal without the earnest money deposit. Earnest money deposit is what's known as smart money. And it's not smart money because it's smart to get it. It's to make the buyer smart or sting if the buyer backs out of the deal without legal justification.
So how can they back out without losing their earnest money deposit?
Well, they can't back out unless they have a legal justification. The legal justifications would be the conditions written into the agreement. And
so
the conditions,
if the appraisal didn't come in or there was something found that we wouldn't be able to negotiate in a home inspection.
You don't usually put in that the agreement is conditional upon the appraisal coming in at a certain amount. You've got a financing contingency. That's a contingency is a condition of the agreement. But before you get to that, I guess that's probably just as good a place as any to continue. A contingency is a condition. And a condition in the agreement says if it fails without the default of either party, in other words, you don't put in a condition that the appraisal will come in a certain amount. You put in a condition that it's conditional upon the purchaser obtaining financing in an amount no less than blank, at an interest rate no greater than blank, and a term no less than blank. That would be typical in terms of finance. Or it might simply say financing which is satisfactory to the buyer, whatever it may be. So anyway, that's a condition. As part of that, the bank is going to do an appraisal, and if the appraisal doesn't come in, that means the financing falls. So now the purchaser has a legal justification to not continue with the agreement. The purchaser is entitled to the earnest money deposit back. However, the seller, and this happens on occasion, the seller says, well, the purchaser didn't really go out and try to get a mortgage. They really didn't act in good faith. They didn't provide the stuff to the lender in time. Had they done what they were supposed to do, they would have gotten the loan. Therefore, I'm not going to authorize release of the earnest money deposit. And buyers don't understand this. They think, oh, I'm leaving the deal. I'm entitled to do it. Even if they're legally entitled to do it, they make a demand for the earnest money deposit. The broker is prohibited under the rules adopted pursuant to the occupational code from turning that over to the buyer without either an agreement from the seller to do so or a civil action in which a judge decrees that the earnest money deposit is to go back to the buyer. So now you got a buyer that's got a grand deposit, you know, something where you really can't afford to go hire a lawyer and go to court over it. I mean, earnest money deposit disputes are, I don't want to say frequent, but they're certainly not uncommon.
And a lot of them, I bet, don't, after a certain period of time, do they escheat to the state?
Yeah, the period for escheat is either 6 or 7 years. I can't remember. And actually, the escheat statute and the rules require that the broker, after having that in the account for so long and neither party making a claim to it, has to file the paperwork to have the funds turned over, escheated to the state. But that's a different issue. The parties don't really care about that. They care about the fact that the deposit needs to be held by somebody under a duty to hold it. If it's the broker, it's going to be typically the selling broker, not the listing broker. It's the selling broker that's going to hold it. But many brokers won't even hold earnest money deposits because in order to do so under the occupational code, they have to have a separate trust account, a non-interest-bearing trust account into which the funds are deposited. Those funds cannot be commingled with the broker's general funds. I mean, I've handled over a dozen cases in which the broker actually, because of a shortage of cash in the operating account, withdrew funds from the trust account. That gets found out by the department. The department then files a complaint, or the aggrieved party files a complaint, and that is a violation of the code. I mean, the biggest one I had was a broker, this is about 10 or 12 years ago, where the broker, because of a shortage of cash over the years, had withdrawn more than $65,000 from the trust account, and then the company went out of business. Well, the flow of funds, it was a large company, they always had funds coming in, so they never had a shortage to be able to pay out of the trust account. Well, when the business shut down, now all of a sudden they have no more deals coming in, no more cash coming in, so they couldn't cover the $60,000 plus deficiency in the account. That's when they got caught. Complaint gets filed. All of a sudden now they're subject to the penalties under the code, which included restitution of the entire amount to the parties. And then they had to struggle to find the parties because some of the parties didn't make a claim. Anyway, the point here is the broker has a duty to hold it. Most deals these days, and every deal I do, I don't like holding earnest money deposits in my trust account. I maintain a trust account, but I don't want the responsibility. In all the commercial deals we do, we have a title company that will end up holding the deposit. And in order to have the title company hold it, there's an agreement with the title company. It's an escrow agreement in which the parties agree that if there is any dispute, they'll pay the attorney's fees of the title company. The title company will file what's called an interpleader action. If the amount is 25 grand or less, it'll be in the district court. If it's more than 25 grand, it'll be in the circuit court, and the parties will have to pay the attorney's fees for the title company if there's a dispute. Sorry for the monologue there, guys.
All right.
I mean, one of the other issues, are you having anybody make non-refundable deposits because of the hot market that's going on? That's one of the incentives that buyers use sometimes is if they have the cash, in other words, they're not concerned about financing, what we will do, and we'll do this in commercial deals too, if we have conditions, particularly an environmental condition, we'll have an initial deposit, which is not a large amount, but it's refundable. But then what we'll do is, upon completion of due diligence, we'll have an additional deposit, and all of a sudden those deposits, quote, go hard, end quote, which means they are now non-refundable. So that after the contingencies are removed, now between that time and the closing, if the buyer backs out, that deposit is non-refundable. Even if the buyer claims to have a reason at that point, it's a non-refundable deposit. And the reason for that is the seller's got the property off the market.
We've done non-refundable deposits if someone has moved in to the property or partially moved in. Most recently, I had someone who moved their stuff into a garage on the property, and there was a non-refundable deposit if it did not close associated with that purchase. That's when I typically see the non-refundable deposit.
Yeah, and that's a little different. That's almost in lieu of rent. In other words, I'm now occupying space in the property, whether it's personal property I've moved in or whatever it may be. So now the deposit becomes non-refundable. We know we've got a deal, unless the buyer backs out, but it's non-refundable between the time that the buyer puts stuff in there, now starts exercising some dominion and control over the property, but it's before the closing. Absolutely. That's a different reason for making it go hard or making it non-refundable.
Well, the excuse me. What happens if the seller defaults? There's no deposit for the buyer in case the seller defaults. I mean, because right now it's possible the seller could default, because if theirs is contingent on finding a home, heck, last week when I looked, I haven't looked today, but we only had 143 houses to pick from in the county in Jackson. Now, we've got a lot of vacant land come on the market, but that takes time to build a house. So what happens if the seller walks away from the transaction?
Well, sellers walk away from the transaction for other reasons, too, not just because they can't find a house, but in this hot market, what happens is they get a better offer. And so now they're scrambling for ways to get out of the first deal, whichever way they can, and so make, whether it's bogus or semi-bogus claim, because they're being offered substantially more money on a second deal. So they breach the agreement. In that case, the purchaser is entitled. You got to read the agreement, because if the agreement says that the purchaser's sole remedy is return of the earnest money deposit, that's what they get. Usually it's the other way around, that if the buyer defaults, the seller's sole remedy is retention of the deposit. That's why it pays to get more deposit than less. But the purchaser's typical remedy is, if I want, I can get return of the earnest money deposit, but what I may do is I may want to enforce the agreement as opposed to getting my earnest money deposit back, because I don't want to simply walk away. I've already got costs in terms of the application fees, the appraisal, the inspection report. So now I've got additional costs, so I don't want just return of my earnest money deposit. I want the seller to either pay me all of the costs I've had plus pay me the time, effort, and pain of going through this, or I want specific performance. And so I file an action. If it's for specific performance, it's got to be in the circuit court. The district court does not have jurisdiction over equitable claims, in this case specific performance. Those are the remedies of the purchaser. I don't want just return of the earnest money deposit.